and welcome to the Day of the Mystic Show. This is episode number 572 with intuitive and author Walter Zajac. This is April 25th, 2022 from Littleton, Colorado. If you've signed up with Blog Talk Radio, you can see and join in the chat. Also, please consider signing up for show announcements through my website at www.davethemystic.com. Well, thank you for joining us tonight with guest Walter Zajac. Walter was born in 1950 in war-torn Kassel, Germany. Half of his city, and every German city, was still bombed out shells of buildings and rubble from World War II American and British bombers. His bricklayer father was a mean, wife-beating alcoholic. His mother was a homemaker, not married to his father. His parents did not tell him that his mother had terminal cancer. Shortly before his sixth birthday, Walter was told he was going to, on an exciting train ride, which ended up at a place called an orphanage, a word he'd never heard, and where he was told he would never go home again. He was shocked and devastated beyond all comprehension. His mother died 6 days after that. A year later, he was adopted by an angry, abusive American military couple who forbid him to talk about his German family, and within weeks were regularly spanking him so severely it drew blood. Walter also endured sexual abuse by two women as a child, which resulted in decades of guilt about sex. He later found sexual health through therapy and studying tantric sex. Walter took comfort in music, playing various instruments professionally from age 15, and settled on drums in a U.S. Air Force band. At 30, he moved back to Germany for 10 years, played all over Europe backing recording artists in concerts, and had a number 18 Billboard charts hit in Europe called Blind Date. Walter had psychic experiences since his earliest memories, which included two imaginary friends. As constant childhood companions, he regularly experienced detailed visions of events in their lives and became emotionally intimate with them. At 44, both these imaginary friends actually became real women in his life, whom he was able to tell multiple things they'd never told anyone. A few weeks of blissful kindred spirit recognition then led to emotional devastation when both women's discomfort caused them to reject Walter severely and even questioned his sanity. Seeking healing, he found a psychologist who is a widely experienced daughter of a Toltec shaman who said emphatically, "You're not crazy, you're psychic." With her help, Walter found his power, inner peace, and self-love. 6 years later, he began his career as a psychic and NLP practitioner and has now brought empowerment to thousands worldwide. He has lived and worked in 12 different countries, which he feels gives him a deeper understanding of people and life. Walter believes we are here on Earth to overcome challenges, to experience contrast in order to understand our true spiritual essence, to love, to be happy, and to have fun. Welcome, Walter. Thank you for being on the show tonight.
Dave, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. That was a great introduction. Not only did you cover my music career, but you covered my sex life. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Appreciate it that you went into so much detail. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, you bring a perspective that I've never looked at. You know, I'm aware it's there, but and that's the devastation in Europe after World War II and all the people digging out and trying to rebuild, and here you were as a child right in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's something that most people don't realize because the Nazis absolutely were evil, and so that's emphasized in all our movies, but the German population actually suffered big time. The city of Kassel, where I was born, went from a population of 236,000 to 50,000 in 6 years, 1939 to 1945. And,
wow.
Yeah, and, you know, regularly I would see men without an arm, without a leg. A friend of my father's was missing two legs and got around on a cart, four-wheel little cart next to the ground. Yeah. So, and then just so much anger, so much violence, so much poverty, because it was a devastated country. And you know, like it said in the introduction, my city was still half rubble and bombed out shells of buildings. At the end of the war, it had been about 90% leveled. And this is according to a study done by Exeter University in the UK. 36 cities in Germany were anywhere from 80 to 95% leveled. And the reason for that was, again, Nazis were just horrifying individuals, and they were hiding munitions factories and tank factories and you name it among the population right in the cities. And so the Americans and British had no other choice than to just do what they called carpet bombing, row after row of bombs coming down. So, wow. Yeah, and that made Germany, 36 cities, right? It's not that big a country. It's about at the size of what maybe Oregon and Idaho combined. So, and then as you pointed out, I was sent to an orphanage and didn't know that my mother was even sick. Well, I saw that she was sick. I did not know that she was dying. And I was the only one in the family that didn't know. And that's how they chose to handle it. And beautifully, my mama had a friend who was a social worker in the part of the government and was able to make arrangements that Americans adopted me, which was a blessing because Germany was so devastated and so poor. And there were no cars. I didn't ride in a car until I was 7. I didn't see a television until I was 6. So, and then, like you mentioned, the point of the story and my psychic journey is that I brought two imaginary friends with me to the orphanage. And I'll talk about the one that was the primary one who was the first one that actually appeared to me as an adult, and that is, I called her the accident girl at the beginning, Maria, in the book. And in this vision that I had, I thought that I had seen a movie with my brother, but when I talked about it later with him, he said that we didn't see that movie. You're crazy. There's nothing like that happened. And so I figured out in my therapy many years later that I had fallen asleep and I had had a vision. But what was significant was this vision was of seeing her. She was about 18, and seeing her interacting with her very loving family and excited about going on a trip with her truck driver father, who drove a big semi with a lot of freight loaded on the back. They got in a horrifying accident, and her face was disfigured and otherwise severely injured. And I saw the details of this over and over and over, including seeing her above her body in the top of the truck cabin. In other words, she was floating above her body and seeing her floating above her body in surgery. I went on a near-death experience with her because she died in surgery and went to the other side, to the light. And when I talk about it, it chokes me up because there are just are no words. It's just beauty beyond beauty. Well, you've been on spiritual journeys. I think you have an idea of what's there. And then I saw the day the bandages came off, and I saw all of this over and over and over in detail. And then on top of that, I connected with her, especially once I was sent to the orphanage and told I would never go home again. I connected with what she went through, this sense of being completely alone in a horrifying situation. And so we became intimate on an emotional level, even though she was imaginary. But, you know, when we're little kids, we're still in tune with where we came from, which I believe is the spirit world. And so it was, you know, and then any child that is psychic or has psychic experiences, we're not aware that, hey, this is a psychic experience now. No, it's just normal. It's just normal everyday stuff for us. And so for me, it was normal everyday stuff to interact with this imaginary girl. And we had conversations. We would fly to clouds together. I would be half dazed, looking at the sky in the meadow with all kinds of kids playing around me, and I would be off in my own world by myself with her. companion. And then when I was 44, I had been talking to this woman. I was, by that time, my music career was over, and I was in what us musicians call a day job. And one of the things that I did regularly was call her company and give prices to the couple of different people there. And one day I made her laugh, and you know this, when we make somebody laugh, we connect. You know, when we are laughing together, somehow our spirits are open and we just connect. And it was the first time I had had any conversation with her other than her saying, "One moment, please, I'll connect you." And then we started speaking personally, and it was just a phone relationship because she was in another city. But then within a few weeks, she said, "I have a confession to make. I was in a horrifying accident." And she started telling me the story of the accident, and I finished the story for her. I finished the story in detail, all those details that I had seen. And then over the course of the next few weeks after that, I told her five things that she had never told another human, which were, among other things, floating on top of her body in the truck cabin, above her body in surgery, the near-death experience, and the bandages coming off, and what happened when the bandages came. And so, you know, when we first connected, there was this sense of recognition that I know you. And I didn't recognize her as Maria, the accident girl, and she didn't recognize me as somebody she had had in a relationship with, because when she was my imaginary friend, it was 15 years before she was even born. And so, you know, initially it was beautiful. Oh, I know you. There's, you know, mystery. And oh, my God, you feel so familiar. And she felt that, too. And then when I began to realize, oh, my God, this is my imaginary friend, then she started freaking out a little bit, because where do you put that? You know, if somebody tells you that, oh, yeah, I've interacted with you all of my life. And then especially when I told her five things that she had never told another human, not long after that, she ended up needing to sever the relationship because it was just too unexplainable. And then it literally, on an emotional level, became somewhat violating to her because, you know, this was before the internet, 94. And how could I possibly know this intimate information about her? It just, it creeped her out. It made her feel unsafe. And, but for me, as you pointed out in the introduction, that was devastating. It was almost as devastating as that first day at the orphanage, because this was my link to my childhood. This was my link to who little Walter is. And then she said it. You might be crazy. How could you possibly know this stuff if you're not crazy, right? And then close friends of mine had been saying for years, because they knew my history and they knew me, and they would say, "Dude, you need some help," just based on what I've been through. And then having this happen was the very thing that made me seek out a psychologist to finally get to the point where, no, I don't have this. I don't have this under control. I need some help. And yeah, I found a woman who is the daughter of a Toltec shaman. And maybe many people in your audience know that Toltec shaman is the teachings of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda. Don Juan Matas. His name, he was a Toltec shaman. Carlos Castaneda became one because Don Juan required that he became an apprentice. And then The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. Don Miguel Ruiz is a Toltec shaman. Mm-hmm. It's a shaman tradition in Central and South America that goes back thousands of years, maybe as much as 10,000. It's beautiful ancient wisdom. But she, I mean, what's significant about this is that since her father was a Toltec shaman, since her earliest memories, he had taken her onto spiritual journeys where she ended up in other realities that were as real as this reality. She ended up in other worlds. She ended up experiencing things that there just was no explanation for, no word for, and it scared the crap out of her. And in our first session, I explained what happened to me. And she said, you know, And I had actually read the teachings of Don Juan at that point, so I knew how crazy it would be to be the daughter of a Toltec shaman. And she said, you know what, compared to what I've seen, what you went through is nothing. And like you said, you're not crazy, you're psychic. And she pointed out that the very fact that I sought these two individuals out in the spirit world to become my companions, that these were two individuals which I subconsciously knew at the time I would meet in my later adult life and who would be the cause of my healing. She said that was me on a psychic level, absolutely setting it up so that I was taking care of myself.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Then, yeah, and then what you mentioned it in the intro, and it's what I really teach all of my clients, no matter what kind of a session I'm doing, and that is she taught me how to love Walter. To love Walter, and the thing that I had become disconnected from was little Walter, because, you know, just automatically, without even giving it a second thought, my impression of little Walter was, well, nobody wanted him, can't be any good, right? Who would love him? Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, and then I think many people in the audience can relate to this, and that is when we hear that the secret to everything is loving yourself. Most of us have a difficult time with that. How do you do that? That's always the biggest question among my clients. And what she taught me was to literally get in tune with little Walter. You know this, you're a scientist. Einstein said over 100 years ago, there is no time, and it's been proven scientifically, experimentally ever since. And so little Walter still exists. And I do this with clients now. She had me sit little Walter on my lap and put my cheek on top of his head in my imagination and feel his hair and smell his skin and feel his little heart beating against my stomach and feel the love of this beautiful little person. And truly, all of us, when we're 5 years old or younger, we're precious, we're sweet, we're innocent, and we're still in tune with where we came from, the spirit world. So we have a wisdom that we lose later on, and we want nothing more than just to be loved. And that seems to be consistent, that none of us as little kids really get enough love. Maybe some, but most of us don't. And so when she took me through that exercise, I cried, because I actually felt him, and I realized, oh, my God, he was beautiful. He was beautiful, little Walter. And I'd never made that connection, because I automatically assumed that, well, yeah, nobody wanted him. How could he be beautiful? But then when I realized that, then I connected those dots and realized, as she pointed out, that's still you, Walter. And that's when I started to actually love Walter, when I see myself as five-year-old Walter, because I'm still that person, and that's the essence of who any of us is, I think. Is the five-year-old in us. Of course, we know we get wise and we get smarter and we have experience, but the truth, the essence of us is that beautiful, innocent, precious, sweet five-year-old.
Well, you went through a lot of events as a child growing up that would lead the average person to say, wow, how do you find it in your heart to forgive those people? How did you work through that as an adult on the forgiveness aspect?
Good question. Thank you. Gratitude is the magic key, and it's something that I have. My therapy was 94, 95, so about 25 years ago. And in the years since, I've used all those tools, but the most important and effective tool that I have come across is gratitude. Gratitude is the antidote to emotional pain. Gratitude is the antidote to fear, most fear. And absolutely, gratitude is the antidote or the key to forgiveness. Not the antidote, but the key, the inside road to forgiveness in my experience. And that is, my adopted father, the military dude, was abusive and mean, and yet he was a amateur musician, and he was excited by the fact that I had natural musical talent, and he bought me instruments. And so when I think of him these days, I say, thank you, man, that was great, that was beautiful, because it was my comfort. It was where I found my peace by getting deeply into the music world, where if I was behind a drum set, I was confident, I could kick ass, as they say, but if I was in a social situation, especially one-on-one with a girl, I was a mess, no emotional confidence. And so I have him to thank for that. And so whenever I think of him, I say, thank you, you know, and then anything else that I can think of. Today, I do eat meat. And today I made some hamburger, and I realized, hey, I'm making it the way he used to make it. And so I said, thank you, man. Thank you for bringing this into my life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's forgiveness, you know, and even my mama, who sent me away, in my therapy, I ended up having to forgive her and understand that she did it because she loved me, because there really wasn't a good alternative other than sending me away to an orphanage. And maybe the thing she could have done differently is told me and said goodbye to me the night before. But it all worked out. And then here's something that I have noticed with friends and colleagues who have gone through hardship in their lives, and that is, I wouldn't change a thing, Dave, because unless I had experienced all of this, I wouldn't be who I am. I wouldn't have the insight and the understanding or the skills that I have, and I wouldn't be able to help anybody else who's in a tough situation, because I wouldn't have any credibility or knowledge. So I wouldn't change a thing. Yeah.
Well, it sounds a little bit similar to my situation. I mean, certainly mine wasn't rough like yours. But my parents divorced when I was around 11, and my brothers, who were older, knew that something was up. I had no idea, and I find out at a family meeting after a Sunday lunch that my dad said, "Yeah, your mother and I are separating," and he had a little bit of a flair for the dramatic. I don't know why he would have said this, but it cut me to the core. He said, "I don't know if I'll ever see you guys again," which, you know, even for the time, this was mid-60s.
Wow,
damn. Yeah, that was still, you know, puffery, but I didn't know the difference. And, divorce was so rare back then, for the sake of the kids. And I went through school for several years not knowing how to fill out paperwork at schools when they say, give your parents names. And I'd have to hold up my hand and say, my parents are divorced. What do I put on this? You know, it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so that was a big shock for me. But in retrospect, I ended up building probably a better relationship with my dad than I would have had otherwise, because he was a workaholic. He started out as an industrial engineer, and then he became an Episcopal priest. And, you know, either one, he would work. He was always gone from our house helping others, you know. And so my brothers all had rather a jaundiced view of him and his activities. He'd be out of the house when I was a kid, when he was a priest. He'd be gone before I had breakfast, because he's going to, do a church service, early morning, or make hospital rounds. And then he'd frequently be home late in the evening. And, we might or might not see him for dinner. A lot of times we didn't. So
he would be in bed already.
We'd get some time with him on Sundays after church in the afternoon. And that was about it, it seemed like.
Well, then, like what I'm sensing, and I'm asking, it seems like the one of the biggest ways that affected you is even before he moved out when you were 11, there was this sense of abandonment because he was never there, which then probably made you at least subconsciously question your own worth. Were you lovable? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I get it, man.
Yeah, I grew up very, very independent. You know, my older brothers were not math types, and so everything I was doing to learn electricity, electronics, engineering, you know, going through junior high and high school, I was doing all on my own. I was taking apart TVs, building electronic kits, becoming a ham radio operator in junior high. I mean, the whole shooting match.
Awesome.
And I made my mistakes, but I didn't have a male figure there, you know, so I was quite independent.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. We have a little bit there in common, too. I was a Boy Scout, and one of the things that my adopted father helped me with is to build a transistor radio. He was pretty much of an a-hole during the process, right? But still, now I can think back and look at that and say, thank you, man, that was a cool experience, because it actually worked. Little headphones, and we actually picked up a signal, right? And it was just on a block of wood. So, yeah, I get it, how exciting that can be. Yeah.
Well, cool. you mentioned in your biography there, NLP. How did you get involved in NLP, and how's it helped you?
Yeah, neuro-linguistic programming is what it stands for, and maybe people know it's a branch of psychology that was developed in the early 1970s, which is what, about 50 years ago now. So it has.
I know, we're
grown.
Getting old, aren't we?
Stop it. So NLP has grown and refined. It was originally started by a hypnotherapist, a PhD, and a psychologist. I think they're both PhDs. And they realized that so much of people's therapy with psychologists was taking longer than it needed to, that there were probably more effective methods to get people healing quicker. You know, things like stopping smoking, things like self-confidence, things like loving yourself, things like getting over a fear of math, for instance. And so they studied the most successful hypnotherapists and psychologists of the time, their most effective methods, and started this branch of psychology, NLP. And it's essentially, like I'm saying, for doing simple things. You know, it's not going to help necessarily a really traumatic experience that is still haunting somebody, but it'll absolutely help you get over childhood and help you find self-love. And so I got certified in it, 7 or 8 years ago, and, you know, passed the test in order to get certified. And it's so very effective, that technique that I was just talking about of putting a 5-year-old Walter on my lap and connecting with him. That's one of the things that I do in NLP for clients, and it's the most effective thing, you know. And like I said, when I really felt little Walter, I cried with joy, and that usually happens when I take clients through that. And then here's something that I'd like to say as far as self-love. You know, one of the things that my psychologist encouraged me to do every session was go home, look Walter in the eyes in the mirror and say, I love you, Walter. I couldn't do it. When I looked to Walter in the eyes in the mirror, I saw all the things that were wrong with him. And that seems to be pretty common among people in our audience, among our clients. But then when I finally made the connection of, oh, well, yeah, I'm still little Walter. And so when I look, and I encourage my clients to do this, and that is, when I look Walter in the eyes in the mirror, I see little Walter's eyes. I feel his energy, and then automatically, oh, I love you. I love you, Walter, and I can say it with passion and mean it. And that's what I encourage clients to do, just to really see the little kid in you and to have a relationship with that little kid, because that's the beauty of you. And then I'm going to do a shameful plug here, shameless plug, and that is, on my website, I have a free meditation for self-love that includes subliminal affirmation tracks. So you can look up what's on those tracks, and then it includes music with theta waves, which is a type of brainwave that allows you to retain the information. But yeah, just, you know, just where you can sit for, lay for 15 minutes or sit and listen to encouragement about loving yourself. And it's free. And the site, the website is psychicwalter.com.
Oh, great. I was hoping you'd mention that. Good. So, yeah, I'm happy to give you a promotion throughout the show. That's fine, so people remember it, depending on where they come in and if they skip around especially. So,
yeah.
Okay, psychicwalter.com. I like that.
It's simple. Even though I present other skills and services, it's simple.
Mm-hmm.
Psychic.
Well, you're probably fairly eclectic. What all do you bring together when you're helping people in terms of different approaches and gifts?
Really all of it. You know, the main thing, no matter what a person is seeking, you know, whether it's an answer to, does my boyfriend love me, or an answer to, am I in the right career, or an answer to, why didn't my parents ever love me? No matter what the question is, the main foundation for the answer is loving yourself. And that's the main thing that I bring in, no matter what the question is. Even if the question is my boyfriend going to call? I bring in that concept of loving yourself. Is this man treating you with respect, with honor? Does he make you feel good about yourself? And is this the best that you believe you deserve? And how do you feel about yourself? And then, of course, yes, I use my psychic ability to tune into the path that you're on, that they're on, and tell them the results of that path. And then, you know, my handle on the internet is the Empowerment Psychic. And so I bring empowerment to every session. And empowerment to me is giving you information so that you can make choices that will bring you the happiness and the results that you want and the love that you want.
Well, how do you help people understand that it's okay to love yourself without feeling like you're crossing the line over into the land of I'm becoming egotistical?
Good question. You know, a simple way that I think about it, one of the simple ways I think about it is, if I don't really love Walter and believe that he is amazing on some level, believe that he has something to offer, if I don't love him enough, then I don't actually have anything to offer. And then even in, especially in a love relationship, if I'm coming in to the relationship questioning whether or not I'm amazing, and yet I want her to think I'm amazing, and every time mm-hmm. she says, oh my God, you're amazing, I'll either believe that she's just trying to make me feel good, or she's stupid, or she's trying to manipulate me somehow. And mm-hmm. the last thing I'll accept is I'm actually amazing, right? So it's just vital that we believe on some level that we are worthy, that we are lovable, and that we make choices that bring those results, and that's the empowerment part. And, you know, gosh, absolute free will, that seems to be universal. And, you know, like what I have noticed, and maybe you've noticed this too, that pretty much every major religion on our planet has some form of, we were created in the image and likeness of the Creator, and some form of this Creator gave us absolute free will, and that those two principles are pretty universal in tribal religions on our planet too.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that we always have free will means we always have the ability to make choices, and to me that's the most powerful thing. And you and I were talking about quantum physics a little bit in the pre-interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I even try to bring that into the story, the fact that all points in time and space are connected. That's one of the results of quantum physics that people are accepting more and more. Well, and if that's the case, then my goodness, if you want your boyfriend to feel good about you, then feel good about him, because that information is getting put out to him on a psychic level. Even if you don't say a word, it's out there on a psychic level, and he's perceiving it, and he is responding to it. And two, if you want the two of you to get closer, faster, same story. Think wonderful thoughts, appreciate, gratitude, appreciate, and thank you, and compliment, and praise, and make it beautiful. And that's what we do at the beginning of a relationship. And more often than not, most of us, as we get into a relationship through time, and sometimes that happens real fast, we start taking each other for granted, and we stop doing the things that we did at the beginning, which is, you know, oh my God, I love it when you look that way, and oh, I love it when you say that, and oh, you're so cute, and you're so smart. We stop doing that at some point, and we shouldn't. We shouldn't. And we can modify it, so maybe it's not as much gushing, and yet the appreciation, the gratitude, the praise, the love has to be there. If you want a lifelong love relationship, do that. Do what you did at the beginning. So that's how I help people. I'll bring in all of that in, too. And then, of course, my goodness, at my age, I've had some experience, right? So I've been through relationships and breakups and a couple of marriages. And because I've been through stuff, then I have experience and skills and tools and insight that other people don't. You know, if you've only studied it at school, it's different than actually going through it. So I help people by just bringing in the wisdom that I have learned through my mistakes.
Well, I think one of the other things that you're talking all around it, but it deserves a good mention here, is living in truth. I think a lot of people have lost a perspective that is so essential to knowing who you are, how you are, and being honest about what you are and what you aren't. And there's so much, you know, especially with all the media and all the social networking stuff, all the online stuff, that just tends to distract people and get them away from the truth. They inflate what they're doing. They inflate this. They inflate that. They make excuses for other people's behavior rather than saying, no, I need to take a stand. And so I think the truth is such a critical thing about, you know, knowing yourself. And the other thing that makes truth very convenient is when you're always truthful, you never have to look over your shoulder worrying about if somebody's going to find you out.
Yeah. Yep. And you don't have to try to remember what story that you told this time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. And I agree with you. Being honest with yourself, I think, is part of what you're saying. Just really seeing you for who you are, seeing the world around you for who they are. But, you know, another thing that and I like what you said, standing up, speaking your truth, but then, you know, the words of Carl Jung, famous psychiatrist, also come to me, and that is, what you resist persists, right? So
yes.
if you choose to fight, then it's going to fight back, or you could also make your own separate peace and, you know, and perhaps consider allowing those people to live the path that they have chosen, even though it's not my path. It's their path, and somehow they're benefiting from it, you know, whether that's maybe because if they're going through hardship, maybe that at some point they will have an epiphany because of the hardship. We don't know, right? So I also go there, and then just allowing people to have their own realities, and they don't need my approval.
Well, you're coming into the example of, you know, as a loving parent, do you let your child touch a hot toaster to help them understand, you know, when I say it's hot, when I say it's dangerous, you should pay attention. And
you might
but I'll
killed.
Let you indulge your curiosity and go ahead and give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. But, yeah, honesty to me is integrity. You have to be honest with yourself and with the people around you. And then, you know, that brings to mind, I mentioned Don Miguel Ruiz and the Four Agreements. the first of which is be impeccable with your word, which he, in my understanding, defines as be honest, but be kind. And ask yourself, does this need to be said? And then if it doesn't, don't say it. But yes, be honest, but kind and loving. And to me, that's being impeccable. And then that includes being honest and kind to yourself. You know, it's one of the things that I'm sure that you run into with clients, and that is people will say, God, I hate myself that I did that. And I'll say, please don't hate yourself. Don't hate yourself. It doesn't serve you. It doesn't serve you. And then please treat yourself as well as you would treat your best friend. You know, in other words, most of us wouldn't suddenly turn on our best friend and hate them and just snap at them and criticize them and judge them and tell them that they're no good. And yet, so many of us do that to ourselves.
Yeah. Well, tell me where you live and where you work with clients.
I live in Los Angeles.
Where have you landed?
I landed in Los Angeles. I've lived here since right after 9/11, actually. And I lived in the Valley. People know the Valley. I lived in Burbank, where it's hot. And now I live about 9 blocks from the beach, where it's cooler and I have the ocean every day. I don't see it from my apartment, but I walk there or drive
there. You benefit from it?
Absolutely, just knowing that it's there, you know. And gosh, if I'm driving back from the grocery store, I'll drive past the ocean just to see it, right? And then, of course, I try to walk there pretty much every day. And that's it's an incredibly meditative place. One of the things that the ocean does for me is, you know, the recognition that, hey, Walter, we live on the water planet. It's what, about 75% water. Right. So when I look at the horizon on the ocean, I realize, wow, this is the planet. And I'm standing on the top of the planet in space. And to me, it's a real powerful feeling. Yeah. And that's one of the things actually that in the teachings of Don Juan talked about. Carlos Castaneda asked him, how do you fight loneliness? And Don Juan said, I have the earth. The earth is a living, sentient being, an intelligent being, and it has a heart, and it has a pulse, and it has a breath. Feel it. Just feel it. And what he does is looks at the horizon, allows his eyes to go a little bit out of focus, and feels the entire planet beneath him and the deep, deep power and vibration of the planet, and sees himself in the universe on this planet. And to me, that's powerful.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, what's next on your list? You've had a successful career working with people on healing. Yeah. You've written a book that's fascinating. Where are you
Thank
going?
You. Yeah. My goal is to reach more people, the masses. It's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. To give people inspiration to overcome their own abandonment. And, you know, clearly, as you know in your own work, abandonment, whether it's physical abandonment, you know, even or emotional abandonment, like what happened to you with your dad just not being there for you. It's so very common. And so, you know, part of my goal in writing the book was to help people overcome their own abuse and abandonment, whether that's physical abuse or sexual abuse. And then, like we've been talking about, to inspire them to really love themselves, but then also to show people that psychic events like deja vu, dreams coming true, like ESP, when you know your boyfriend's going to call, or you know what they're feeling before they call, those things also are really very common. And so one of my goals is to just bring that out to the world as a sense of this is who you are, it's normal, and it is your power. Just including these things in your life causes you to become more powerful. And I live here in in Hollywood, as they say. And of course, you can't help it. If you have a social life, you meet friends in the film industry and TV industry, and people have told me that, oh my God, this book would make a fantastic movie or a miniseries. So that's my goal. I want it to become a movie or a miniseries to reach more people.
Well, I hope you find it. Good luck with that.
Thank you. Yeah. My feeling is I will. Yeah. It's it's epic. You know, like you said in the introduction, it starts in war-torn Germany, and then, yeah, I go through a music career where, gosh, the biggest audience I ever played for was 27,000 people. Just an amazing thrill.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That must have been very gratifying.
Oh, it was. But as you know from your own work, that really reaching somebody in a session, really helping them understand themselves, really helping them in a situation where they really love themselves and treat themselves well enough to get the result that they want, that's incredibly fulfilling. And to me, it's actually more fulfilling than playing for 27,000 people.
Very cool.
You know, and that was one of the things that when I was a musician, that you know, I hoped every time that I played to reach hearts. You know, whether it was a slow song or a song that makes you dance in your seat, wanted to reach hearts, but you never know, right? And yeah, if the audience cheers, right, but they might just be cheering for the guitar player, right? So when I really help people one-on-one, it is more fulfilling because I have really powerfully affected somebody's life in a beautiful way, and that's very fulfilling. That's love. Dave, that's what we do.
Well, I have a lot of admiration for gifted musicians. I grew up and I played the trombone from elementary school through high school, and I thought I was pretty good. But I never became intuitive about the trombone. Yeah, I was always still thinking about the mechanics of playing it. And I've seen on stage musicians who. They're never going to hit a wrong note. It would be impossible for them to hit a wrong note. You know, it is not in their consciousness to play a wrong note. And you see them just, become one with their instrument. I saw a guitarist who was, I think, with a traveling group that was doing a recreation of the Beach Boys or something. And the guy just, he was one with his instrument. He had disappeared into his instrument. It was just fantastic. And, I just have such a high admiration for people who have reached that level of, performance.
And that, too, was amazingly fulfilling in its own right. In accompanying recording artists, there would be three or four or five recording artists on a particular show, and only one band, and we had to sight read their music. You know, they would bring written notes, and we would go through the show once in rehearsal, and the next time we went through the show was in front of thousands of people. And you had to have a mastery of your instrument in order to not get lost in the notes, right? Like you said, to become one with your instrument so that the notes have some meaning, so that what you're putting out there actually sounds a little bit like the record. All right, so yeah, that was also very, very thrilling, and thank you for recognizing that. And then I need to say, trombone's one of my favorite instruments. I love trombone. Yeah, and being a drummer, of course, I love drums of any kind. So the last few years, I've really gotten into salsa music, and there are a ton of, almost every band has at least one trombone player, if not two. It's a big deal in salsa. So I'm always aware of the trombone. I like that. And, you know, that's interesting, too, that you had that sensitivity as an artist before you became a scientist, a rocket scientist. And then on top of that, when you met that I saw it in one of your interviews, you met that friend who was, I think you said, an FM disc jockey. And he showed you. He put the television on snow and stepped back and with his mind changed the channel, right? When that happened, absolutely. That you realized that that was a big part of you too, this sensitivity, this, well, and then I think that the spiritual dynamics that you felt from your dad's abandonment, even before he actually left, it put you in a place where you just recognized that, wow, I have to make that a part of my life, the spirituality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, that I find fascinating to you.
Yeah, I became closer to my dad later on, and after doing his industrial engineering again, after he divorced my mother, years later, he returned to the priesthood to do supply clergy work in Minneapolis.
Wow.
And he was married to his third wife and raising a couple new kids in his family. And well, in about 2013, after a couple years of doctors ignoring his complaints about his back hurting, just saying, well, you're old, you know, backs hurt when you walk. One of them finally did an x-ray and found he had a lung cancer that had tied into the back of his lungs into where the ribs attached to the spine, and that's where he was getting his pain, was having a tumor there. But when he found that out, it was right around my birthday in 2013, and I made plans to go up and see him as soon as I could. And so I was sitting with him, and at that point I'd talked to him for a couple of years, and especially in the last year or so, about where I'd gone spiritually and the gifts that had come to me. And he looked at me and he said, well, the oncologist has told me that I have like a year and a half to 2 years to live. What do you get? And I checked in with my spiritual sources, and I said, you have 4 months. And he goes, well, I guess I better get cracking and get all my paperwork and everything lined up. And he did, and he died about 4 months and 1 week after that conversation.
Wow. Well, and Dave, how beautiful that he gave you that much credibility and faith to believe you that it was going to be 4 months. That's beautiful. And then it's even beautiful that I'm thinking in the chronology of how it happened, he set the tone of going from an engineer's job to a spiritual job, and then you echoed that in your own life, right? That's cool. That's beautiful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels, and I look at a lot of people who are engineers their whole life, and they retire, and then their life has very little meaning for them because they're very one-dimensional, and you know, they were engineers, they liked the rigor of engineering, they liked discipline, they liked the concrete answers, and then suddenly one day they say, well, okay, I finally earned my reward, I earned my pension, and I'm out of there, and you know, within 6 months in my job after I left Lockheed, I ended up working for a company that provided contract labor, and these people will be approaching me, gee, do you have any work I could do? Because, you know, after 6 months of being retired, it was just like, you know, their wives wanted them out of the house.
You know? Yeah, I get it.
You know, please go find something to do with your spare time here.
Yeah.
And they, you know, not really had hobbies. They not, you know, the kids were grown up and gone. And so they had to rethink their lives. But a lot of them, you know, had a very difficult time. With that.
Yeah, and you solved that problem by turning to your spiritual.
Well,
work.
I did. Beautiful. Yeah,
yeah, very cool. And having a show, my goodness, having a show every week. You know, I've been doing shows to promote my book, and I'm realizing as I get to know hosts and what you guys go through that, oh my gosh, it's a lot of work. I appreciate you, Dave. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, I appreciate you showing up. The worst experience I had was I met this one guy at a conference, and I'm on the show waiting for him to call in, and he's not calling in. I get on my house line, and I call his house or call the number they had given me, and he doesn't answer. And I finally just have to tell people I'm sorry I didn't have an alternate show prepared or ready to go, and I'm going to have to just come back next week. I hope that the guest is okay. I got a hold of him later, and he was unapologetic. He said, "Oh, well, things were busy, and I took a nap and fell asleep and lost track of the time."
Oh,
and that was it.
Man. Whoa. Gosh, that's brutal,
like,
huh?
Wow.
Oh, man.
You don't do this, you know? I mean, that's...
No. And I know from my experience with you that you do a lot of preparation for a show. So, yeah, I get
it. Yeah. Well, I apologize for not having read your full book, but I'll claim, well, I had have a vacation interfering here, so.
Well, yeah, you're in Vegas, man. I'm happy for you.
I want to see what the punchline is.
Yes. Yeah. Cool. Yes.
Well, we're about out of time here. What do you have coming up that you want people to know about?
Buy the book, They Came, Beyond Deja Vu. It's available on Amazon as a paperback, as a Kindle, and an audiobook with me narrating it. And go to psychicwalter.com. You can listen to or read 5 scenes from the book, and then go to psychicwalter.com to get a free MP3, a 15-minute self-love meditation with affirmations and theta waves.
Okay. And I assume through your website, if people would like to have an appointment with you, they can find a way
Absolutely.
To contact you for that.
Yes, that's the key word. Click on any link that says appointment on it, and you can see my prices and my calendar.
Pardon me.
Bless you. Yeah. Also, you know, I just wanted to add, one of my favorite things that really has affected my life is, and it's something that I've learned in studying near-death experiences and in knowing Daniel Brinkley, or his work, I should say, and that is Albert Hubbard, an American poet in the 1800s, said, "Don't take life too seriously. You'll never get out of it alive." And to me, that says, oh, my God, have fun. Right. And to me, that's the secret to happiness, because all we ever have is right now. And most of us want to be happy, but we put it off, you know, to some event. All we have is right now. If you want to be happy, have fun. If you want to be happy, have fun. Now, that's it. That's my story. I'm sticking
Absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, thanks again for being on. And again, the book title is They Came, Beyond Deja Vu, by Walter Zajac, Zajac. I hope I'm saying that right.
You are. Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thanks for asking. Yes.
Okay. And for our listeners, please join us next week with Dr. Joanna Kujawa, and it should be a fascinating interview. Thank you for listening tonight, and blessings. Take care.